Audio Mystery Theatre presents The Ornamental Hermit, a D.S. Billings mystery. Part 6, in Cumberland.
Mr. Pringle? Mr. Pringle? I'm Detective Sergeant Billings from the Metropolitan Police. I'd like to speak to you, if I may.
Huh?
It's about a case you handled 10 years ago.
A case? 10 years ago?
A missing person case. Sebastian Forrester?
Did you say the Metropolitan Police?
Yes.
Scotland Yard?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. I've never been visited by a Scotland Yard inspector before. What is it precisely you want from me?
Do you remember Mr. Frederick Forrester?
Mr. Frederick Forrester. Yes, I think I remember his name.
He employed you 10 years ago to find his son who went missing in the area.
Oh, yes, I remember now. A young tourist who came for the lakes. Killed himself, didn't he?
Did he?
I think he did.
Well, it appears he didn't. Mr. and Mrs. Forrester have received a letter.
From him?
Or someone claiming to be him. I've reopened the case and was wondering whether I could discuss it with you.
Why, certainly you may. Come in. It is a great honour to be asked to help out someone from Scotland Yard. Sit down, please, Mr...
Billings.
I assure you I shall do everything in my power to assist you. Now, let me get his file. Mr. Forrester was a banker, was he not? And his son, a divinity student.
You have a good memory, Mr. Pringle.
Yes, I do. I've always had a great memory. The mother used to call me a walking encyclopedia. Ah, here it is. Mr... Forrester must be quite an important man for the Yard to be involved.
This is not an official investigation.
Oh?
Mr. Forrester is a personal friend of mine. I'm doing this as a favour.
I see. So it's not a Scotland Yard case?
No. Mr. Forrester received a letter from somebody in Oxford claiming to be his son. When he went to Oxford to meet him, he vanished. I have compared the handwriting from the letter he received with that of the letters he had written before, and they matched, so I am now working under the supposition that Sebastian Forrester is still alive.
Quite plausible. After all, no body has been found.
The last place we know him to have stayed at is the Lakeside Hotel on the banks of Lake Windermere.
That's right. That's what it says in my file.
What I would like to determine, with your assistance, is what became of him when he left the hotel.
Well, let us see. He checked into the hotel on the 19th of March, 1880. He looked pensive and subdued, according to Mr. Tavistock, the hotelier. And according to Mr. Forrester, that had at the time been his normal disposition. On the morning of the 22nd, Sebastian Forrester told Mr. Tavistock that he was going to take a trip on a steamer and would be back late, to which Mr. Tavistock replied, there probably weren't any steamers sailing yet, as it wasn't quite the season for it, but that he hoped he'd have a nice day anyway, and that he'd tell the cook to prepare a cold supper for him when he returned. Unfortunately, Sebastian Forrester didn't return that night, nor indeed any other night. He disappeared, leaving all his clothes and luggage behind him, and his bill unpaid.
Do we know anything of his movements on that day?
Yes, indeed we do, Mr. Billings. I did make inquiries, and it turns out that a steamer did cruise the lake on that day, and the captain confirmed Sebastian Forrester was on it. It was easy for the captain to recognise him, because he only had 3 passengers on that particular trip. Sebastian Forrester, a woman, and her daughter. The woman and daughter were local people. She sold flowers to tourists, while her daughter was left on the bank staring with awe at the steamers cruising the lake. It had been a long-cherished desire of the little girl to sail on one of those boats herself, and upon hearing this, Sebastian Forrester treated the girl and her mother to a trip. I don't know if any of this is significant, but it seems to have moved the old Mr. Forrester when I told him about it, so I made a note of it in my records. I pay attention to this sort of thing, you see. In a case like this, when a young man deserts his family, there are often personal histories which one doesn't like to pry into, but which can reveal a lot, so I always like to record people's reactions when I report my findings.
Do you know where he got off?
Yes, I do. According to the captain, he got off at Ambleside on the north end of the lake. The woman and daughter remained on the boat and returned to Bowness. The captain asked Sebastian whether he wanted to be picked up again, but Sebastian said no, which the captain thought peculiar. He wasn't carrying any bags or even wearing a coat. I have 2 more pages of this report. Would you like me to carry on?
Please do.
You can see I've been thorough. Sebastian was spotted walking down a footpath by the minister of Brathay Church, who spoke to him briefly and said he looked glum and distracted. The footpath goes right through the fells, all the way to Coniston Water, but I'm afraid that's where the trail ends. There were no further identifications of Sebastian by any of the other people I spoke to.
So, what do you think became of him?
Well, it's a long footpath. It was a little past 3 when he got off at Ambleside, and it starts getting dark at around 5:30 in March. Where would he have slept? Remember, he had no coat and wasn't carrying anything to keep him warm. There is an inn further down the footpath, the Drunken Duck, which lies in Barngates, but he wasn't spotted there either. The Drunken Duck is a tavern for local farmers and farmhands, so a young gentleman like that would most certainly have stood out. My conclusion is that he must have left the road altogether and either headed into the woods or returned to the lakeside.
Why would he head into the woods?
I don't know. Perhaps he didn't wish to be seen by anyone.
Why would he wish not to be seen?
Well, presumably he was up to no good, Mr. Billings. Otherwise, why would he run away?
At Scotland Yard, we are taught not to presume, Mr. Pringle. And anyway, he was seen, wasn't he, by the minister of Brathay Church, according to your own report?
Oh, we searched the woods extensively. I hired a number of men to comb the area, but we found no evidence of his presence.
I'm still not clear, Mr. Pringle, why you felt you had to search the woods.
Well, we had to start the search somewhere.
It must have been quite an expensive operation, combing the woods.
Mr. Forrester told me no expense was to be spared.
Do you have any justification for spending such a large amount of Mr. Forrester's money?
I was working on a particular theory, Mr. Billings.
And what theory would that be?
I've already explained that several witnesses confirmed that Sebastian looked distraught, and that his father agreed that he was. My theory is that he came to the Lake District suffering from melancholia.
And you believe he committed suicide?
Yes, I did.
And hanged himself from a tree?
Possibly. Or otherwise, he returned to the lake and drowned himself.
So you dragged part of the lake?
Indeed, I did.
Another expensive operation, no doubt.
It is a lengthy and labour-intensive process, Mr. Billings. It does not come cheap.
Where does Bog Lane lead to?
It leads to the village of Brantwood on the bank of Coniston Water, which is about 7.5 miles from Ambleside.
He could have walked that in one night.
Without being seen?
Didn't you say it was already dark?
Well, yes, but...
It seems to me he walked through the night all the way to Brantwood. Did you make any inquiries there?
No, I did not. There is no reason to believe Sebastian Forrester went to Brantwood. He'd have checked out of the hotel and taken his belongings with him if that had been his intention.
Perhaps it was a decision made on the spur of the moment. Did you explore any other avenues?
Mr. Forrester and I agreed to end the investigation after we dragged the lake.
I'm not surprised after the expense incurred.
I did keep an eye out for noteworthy stories which appeared in the local newspapers. There was one story in the Whitehaven News which interested me at the time, but as I had already closed the investigation, I didn't follow it up. Here's the article. I'm not sure why this intrigues me. Perhaps it's just my instinct, but I do find that when two unusual occurrences happen in the same period of time, even if they seem completely unrelated, they're usually connected.
A pile of gentlemen's clothing was found in the middle of a field in the small Copeland village of St. Bees. The items were discovered by Jedediah Took, a local shepherd, as he grazed his flock. They looked like high-quality clothing to me, said Mr. Took. Shirt, striped trousers, waistcoat. And smart, too, not the kind of donkey jackets us wears around these parts. The clothes, which included a pair of shoes and long cotton drawers, had been left neatly folded in the middle of the field. He took off everything except his hat, said Mr. Took. Can't think why anyone would want to undress here. The items of clothing are currently being held by the police. Villagers have been advised to direct any naked man wearing nothing but a hat to the local police station, where his clothes will gladly be returned. I don't suppose you know what Sebastian Forrester was wearing at the time.
I'm afraid that's a detail I didn't think to ask.
Hello there.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, brother. I was wondering if you could tell me where this path leads to.
This path? Well, it goes all the way to St. Bees, and if you keep following it from there, you'll end up in Whitehaven.
Is it far to St. Bees?
Another few hours by foot, I should think.
So I won't make it before sundown?
No. Have you been walking long?
All day. I set off from Kendal early this morning.
Are you a tourist?
Something like that. I came across this interesting path when I explored the lakeshore and wondered where it led to.
Without a map, you could have got lost.
Well, it was quite liberating to put myself at the mercy of fate. And anyway, I didn't think I'd get lost if I kept to the path. It must lead somewhere. Where am I now?
This is the Priory of the Holy Virgin.
Are you Franciscan?
No, we're Cistercians. You can spend the night here if you wish.
Oh, well, I wouldn't want to be any bother.
St. Benedict's rule compels all monasteries to receive guests with reverence and kindness, so you'll not be a bother. We have a special cell for visitors. It's very basic, but it will provide you with shelter for the night. Follow me.
My name is Billings, by the way, John Billings.
You can call me Brother Martin. This is it. This is the cell.
What an odd-looking building. Looks rather like a beehive.
It's a Celtic cell. It's what medieval Irish monks used to live in.
This building has been here since the Middle Ages.
Oh, no. It was built several years ago by a hermit.
Hermit?
The priory was built on the foundations of a Celtic monastery, which was dedicated to St. Bago, after whom the village of St. Bees is named, but which was destroyed during the dissolution of the monasteries under Henry VIII. We are particularly interested in Celtic Christianity at this priory, and some of us have tried to emulate the life of the early Irish monks.
Why?
The early Celtic monks were quite different to modern-day monks. Ireland was the only country in Western Europe not to have been Romanized, you see. It was the Romans who spread Christianity in Europe, and even after the decline of the Roman Empire, Roman influence still lingered throughout Europe, but not in Ireland. Ireland remained isolated and free from any Roman influence. So, when Christianity arrived there, it grew and evolved in a very special manner. There was a particular book which was very influential in Ireland at the time, Sayings of the Desert Fathers.
Sayings of the Desert Fathers? Oh my God, I have that book.
Ah, you're reading it. How wonderful. The Vatican feared this book at first, because it took power away from them. They didn't want people to find their own connection with God. They wanted to be the bridge to heaven. That's why we call the Pope the Pontiff. But the Irish were free from Roman influence, and that included the Vatican. They took this book to heart, but they adapted it to suit their own surroundings. There were no deserts in Ireland, but there were islands and bogs and other inhospitable locations. So the Irish set up monasteries there. They took to the seas in their small leather boats and went wherever God's winds blew them. It is fascinating, Mr. Billings, truly fascinating. But tell me, why is it you carry this book around with you?
It belonged to a friend of mine who went missing. I'm a detective. I'm investigating his disappearance. Have you been at this priory long?
4 years.
So you weren't here when the Irish cell was built?
No.
And do you know the man who built it?
No. I know he went by the name of Brendan.
Brendan?
He resided here for a few months, but has long since disappeared. Ah, it's Vespers. I'd better be off. You can join us in the priory after Lord's for breakfast, if you wish. I bid you a good night.
Good night. Good afternoon. I'd like to speak to a superintendent, please.
A superintendent, no less.
I am Detective Sergeant Billings from Scotland Yard.
Detective Sergeant Billings from Scotland Yard. Well, well, well. Have you any identification?
Here is my badge.
Well, this badge looks genuine enough.
That's because it is genuine. Now, please, will you let me see the superintendent?
The superintendent's not here, Mr. Billings. He's down at the arbour, working on a case.
When will he be back?
It's hard to say. There's never any way of telling how long these things are going to take, is there? You should have sent us notice. You can't expect our superintendent to be at your beck and call, Mr. Billings. Even if you are from Scotland Yard.
Is there someone else I can talk to?
Well, that depends on what it is you want to talk about, Mr. Billings.
I'm working on a missing persons case and I need to take a look at your records.
To take a look at our records? We can't allow just anyone to come in and browse our records, Mr. Billings. This isn't a public library.
I'm not just anyone.
No, you're Detective Sergeant Billings from Scotland Yard. Who is this missing person you're looking for, if I may ask?
His name is Sebastian Forrester.
He must be a very important man if Scotland Yard is involved.
This is not an official investigation.
Not an official investigation?
This is a private investigation. I'm doing a favour for a friend.
So you're not from Scotland Yard?
I am from Scotland Yard. I'm on my annual leave.
I see.
Now, may I please speak to someone about this?
What precisely is it you wish to speak to someone about, Mr. Billings?
I need some information about some clothes which were found at St. Bees.
Yeah, you're not a reporter, are you?
A reporter?
You are aware it's against the law to impersonate a police officer.
I am not a reporter, Sergeant. I'm a genuine police detective. You have my badge in your hands.
Scotland Yard hasn't reopened the case of the mutilated monks, has it?
The what?
The great scandal at the Priory of the Holy Virgin 9 years ago, where the clothes were found.
Yes, that's right. We have opened that case again.
But everything there is to know about the case has already been printed in the papers. There's nothing new to report.
May I please speak to someone superior?
I shall have to check with the boss. This might take a while.
Take your time.
So, you're from Scotland Yard, eh?
That's right, Inspector Blunt.
And you say this is a private case?
Yes.
Is that allowed?
I'm doing it in my own time and I'm not being paid for it.
You'll pardon my eating, but this is actually my lunch break. Beef and oyster sandwiches. Want one?
No, thank you.
You sure? I can get Constable Goodthwaite to buy you one.
I'm sure, thank you.
So, the scandal at St. Bees. I'm surprised you haven't heard of it before. It was big news over here. Perhaps it wasn't reported on down south. I don't suppose you lot care much about what goes on up here.
It's not that. I just don't read the papers regularly.
You don't read the papers?
Not unless it's relevant to a case I'm working on. I find them depressing.
However did you get to work for Scotland Yard with that attitude? How are you getting on back there, Goodthwaite? Found the file yet?
It might help if I knew the precise date, sir.
1881 or 1882, thereabouts.
Perhaps you could fill me in a bit while the constable searches for the report.
Perhaps I could. Oh, pardon me. Well, basically what happened, Mr. Billings, is that a doctor from St. Bees was called out to the priory to attend to two monks who had been injured. When the doctor arrived, he found the two monks lying feverishly in their beds. And after further inspection, he saw that their tongues had been sliced off.
Their tongues?
That's right. Their tongues. The doctor said, the prior had told him, that the monks had sliced off their own tongues 2 days before, and that the prior had tried dealing with the injury himself, but that he was unable to avoid the monks' mouths from becoming infected, and had no choice but to call for the doctor.
Why did they slice off their tongues?
Well, the prior was being very cagey about that, which is why the doctor informed the police and why an inquiry was launched, which even involved the Bishop of Liverpool having to come over to Whitehaven to testify.
What was the outcome of the inquiry?
The outcome was that the monks had inflicted their own injuries in an attempt to take their vows of silence to an extreme, and that the prior was entirely ignorant of this decision and was therefore not to be blamed. The two monks weren't official members of the order and lived separately from the priory in some sort of stone hut.
A Celtic cell?
A Celtic cell, that's right. Well, these two monks, or novices, lived together, you see, in this Celtic cell. One of them was called Pelagius, and the other one...
Brendan.
That's right. Brendan. So, you have read about this, Mr. Billings. Well, something very peculiar was going on between those two monks in that cell. Something very peculiar indeed, if you know what I mean. You know what these Catholic clergy are like, Mr. Billings? Dirty little buggers, the lot of them. What do you think, Goodthwaite?
Sir?
Are you Catholic?
Church of England, sir.
Good lad. Well, they were expelled, of course. One of them returned several years later and is still there. As for the other, well, he came here to Whitehaven. He was taken in by a tanner, a notorious character by the name of Barnabas Crook.
Taken in? Do you mean employed?
Well, if you can call it that. Crook just placed Brendan in the middle of King Street, just around the corner from here, in fact, where he'd sit all day with his cap on the floor, begging. He made a very pitiful impression, did Brendan. His eyes, you know. There was something deeply melancholic about them, and the way he'd sit perfectly still on that cold concrete floor, in all kinds of weather, shivering sometimes, and pale and wet. You attracted a lot of pity and attention and made a fair amount of money in the process, which Crook then took off him in exchange for food and a bed.
Where is this Barnabas Crook? Could I speak to him?
He's gone, I'm afraid. He landed in the House of Correction in Peter Street a couple of years ago after an attempted burglary, but disappeared with his son after he was released. Well, good riddance as far as I'm concerned. They were crooks by name as well as by nature.
So what happened to Brendan?
I don't know, Mr. Billings. He wasn't seen again after Crook got arrested. You got that report yet, Goodthwaite?
I think I have, sir.
There you go, Detective Sergeant Billings. That's the report about the clothes, and there's the confession Brendan wrote for us when we pulled him into the station. That should tell you all you need to know about the Priory scandal.
I joined the Priory in March 1880. You needn't know anything about my life before that, except that it wasn't much of a life. In fact, it was no life at all. It was a period of gestation, a womb in which I grew and developed. My real life started on that cold spring day in 1880, when, after wandering aimlessly through the hills and lakes of Cumberland, I stumbled quite unexpectedly upon a priory just outside the village of St. Bees. The sun broke through the clouds, and a beam of light illuminated the chapel. I knew immediately what I had to do. I took off all my clothes and walked towards the priory, naked like a newborn babe, freed from all my possessions and my previous incarnation. I've been driven here by God.
Why are you undressed? Where were your clothes?
I have no clothes.
What is your name?
I have no name.
Where do you come from?
Nowhere. I have no history.
This is not an asylum. We're not a charity. This is a Christian retreat for men who seek to be closer to God. You should go to the police station or the poorhouse if you're in any trouble.
I'm not looking for asylum. I received a calling from God, and the Lord has led me here.
Please, will you put your clothes back on and send us a letter? This is not the way to approach a house of God.
I have no clothes. I gave up everything as God commanded me to. I'm only doing what God asks of me. If you refuse to let me in, I'll sleep on your doorstep until you change your minds. If you refuse to feed me, I'll simply starve outside your gates. You have no choice in the matter. God has decided.
They gave in after that. They quickly grabbed a spare tunic from a chest and wrapped it around me. They reluctantly agreed to take me on as a novice. There was another novice at the Priory, John Morgan, a simple young lad who'd had brain fever at the age of 5, leaving him weak in mind and body. He must have been only 16 or 17 when his parents dumped him at the Priory. The poor lad was forced to live alone amongst these dour middle-aged monks, so when I moved in, he was naturally very happy to have the company of someone his own age. He followed me everywhere and talked incessantly. He talked as we scrubbed the floors or emptied the piss pots. He talked while we picked the apples or pruned the trees. He talked while we milked or grazed the cows. He talked about everything. What he felt, what he thought, what he saw, what he did. All he hadn't been able to say in the last few years, he now unleashed on me. It drove me to despair. This was supposed to be a silent order, and this simpleton's incessant chatter was restricting my ability to meditate and commune with God. I begged the brothers to grant me refuge from our resident imbecile, by allowing me to study with them for a couple of hours each day. But they refused. The books which had been imported from the Mother Abbey in Dijon were fragile and valuable and were not to be touched by a novice. These were not the famous canons to which I had already been exposed in my previous life. These were obscure texts, written long ago by people living on the fringes of Christendom. I told them that the daily routine at the Priory was too boring and monotonous for me, and that I longed desperately for the world of knowledge which lay hidden from me. But the brothers argued that enduring and cherishing this monotony would bring me closer to God. I disagreed. I told them that it was only the body which needed to be punished and exhausted. The mind needed to be enlightened, or it would starve. And if the mind starved, then so did the soul. After 5 months of pleading, the brothers finally gave in. Suddenly, a whole new world opened up to me. The brothers had been particularly interested in Celtic Christianity, and their library was filled with books about the Celtic saints. I read all about St. Patrick, the enslaved shepherd boy who broke free from his shackles and converted the high kings of Ireland. And St. Kevin, who lived in a cave, slept on a bed of rock, and prayed for hours submerged to his chin in the icy waters of Glendalough. And the most fascinating saint of them all, St. Brendan, who took to the sea in a small leather boat and ventured into the unknown, looking for the Isle of the Blessed, making it all the way to America. The Priory held a copy of the Navigatio, the book which details his epic journey, and I read it over and over again. The Irish monks had a great tradition of sailing into the unknown. Like the desert fathers of Egypt, they saw the sea as their watery desert, and they would give themselves over completely to its winds and currents. The lives of the Irish monks moved me profoundly, and I desperately tried to emulate them. Soon I had made myself a new tunic from rough, untreated sheep's wool, shaved my head in the style of the Irish tonsure, and called myself Brendan. I then begged the brothers to allow me to construct a Celtic cell on their grounds so that I could live in it in solitude and expose my body to the elements. And so John Morgan and I wandered the hills and valleys, looking for flat stones with which to construct our cell. Soon we had built a strong and sturdy beehive, and we moved in. But the experiment failed. It was supposed to be a life of basic simplicity, of not eating or wearing more than was necessary to keep the body alive, of enduring pain and discomfort with serenity, of suffering in stillness. But all of this was impossible with John Morgan. I simply could not make him understand what we were trying to achieve. No matter how I endeavoured to ignore him, John Morgan could not stop from talking. It wasn't just in his nature to be chatty. There was something wrong with him neurologically. He kept on babbling, repeating the same old nonsense, not caring whether or not he was being listened to. There was no desire to express anything. It was more as if his mouth had been wired to his brain and moved with every thought that occurred to him. Even in his sleep, I could see his mouth move and hear him mutter nonsense. I wondered whether perhaps it was this condition that led his parents to dispose of him at the Priory. The notion of cutting off his tongue was a frivolous one at first, one born out of anger and frustration. But as time progressed, that idea seemed to carry greater weight. Silence would bring John Morgan closer to God, as it would me. If I cut my own tongue out first, John Morgan would inevitably follow. I could live without a tongue. I had no need for taste or speech. It would be a commitment to God, a sacrifice. And so it happened. One morning, I took the shears we used in the orchard, stuck my tongue between the shears, and squeezed until I held the dead, bleeding flab of meat in my fingers. The pain was excruciating. It struck every nerve in my face and made my stomach turn. But I had meditated beforehand, and I took the pain, as I had taught myself to do, cherishing every stinging beat. Then, with a mouthful of blood, I handed the shears to John Morgan, who had been sitting before me, watching the act with silent awe. Yes, he was silent then. It hadn't occurred to me before, but I remember it now. John Morgan took the shears from me and without hesitation cut off his tongue. He cried out like a slaughtered pig, alerting the brothers. I don't really need to tell you what happened next. The brothers made a botched attempt at stitching John Morgan's tongue back up and gave us alcohol to rinse our mouths with, but they were unable to fight off infection. They were forced to call for a doctor after a few days, and the doctor eventually alerted the police. And so here I am now, in this police station, writing my statement. I am mute and homeless, and my infected frenum has caused a vile odour in my mouth, which continues to repulse other people. But I have no regrets. I did what I did for God, knowing that it would cause me a lifetime of suffering. This has been my commitment, my sacrifice. I shall continue to live my life as though crucified, in struggle, in lowliness of spirit, in goodwill and spiritual abstinence, in fasting, in penitence, in weeping.
In this episode, the parts were played as follows. Billings, David Ault. Edmund Pringle, Brother Martin, Ivan Wilkinson. The Whitehaven Sergeant, Mike Young. Inspector Blunt, the Prior, Aubrey Parsons. PC Goodthwaite, Sean Mendham. Sebastian, Matt Sykes. Audio Mystery Theatre is free to listen to, but not free to make. If you want to show your appreciation, please consider buying us a virtual cup of coffee at ko-fi.com/audiomysterytheatre. That's ko-fi.com/audiomysterytheatre. With theatre spelt the British way. That is, with RE at the end.